Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl.
Kia ora, listeners. I'm here today with Mike Lee, who has kindly made room in his busy schedule to come in and tell us about his new book, extremely new, hot off the press, I might say, Navigation and Naturalists, French Exploration of New Zealand and the South Seas, 1769 to 1824. Kia ora, Mike. Thank you so much for being here.
Kia ora, Karen, and thank you very much for inviting me on the program.
My pleasure. Now, Mike Lee doesn't really need an introduction once you clarify that Mike Lee, the author and the scholar, is Counselor Mike Lee, representing the Waitemata and Gulf Ward for the last 8 years, and previously, and especially, Chairman of the Auckland Regional Council, appreciated there and elsewhere for the active role he's taken with regard to conservation, particularly in the Hauraki Gulf. He's a former Merchant Navy officer, I'm putting this in because I think this has a bearing on the book, Inside Knowledge, who earned a Master of Science in Biological Sciences. And it was writing your master's thesis that awakened your interest in the subject matter of this book. Am I correct, Mike?
That is essentially correct, Karen, yes.
So many years ago, it was many years in the making. Wait, what year did you get your master's?
It goes back to my interest in the French exploration of the Pacific goes back to my time when I was at sea as a young guy, and perhaps the first time I was became curious was when we sailed from Niue to Auckland. I think it was about June 1973 on a beautiful winter's day in the subtropics, and we sail past the Kermadec Islands. And I guess that was the first awakening of my curiosity about the French discovery or the French exploration of the Pacific. And later on, I was on another ship altogether, and some years later, again, on the New Zealand coast. In the meantime, I'd been away working for a Hong Kong company on worldwide tramping, Jardine Matheson's, the old East India Company drug dealers. but back on the New Zealand coast, and I remember being on the Coastal Trader, which was quite a good job for someone wanting to be closer to home, as I was at that stage, going around the East Coast. And I sailed with Chief Officer Pat Fian. And I came onto the bridge one afternoon after my radio watch, and on the chart room table, Pat had Beaglehole's Voyage of the Endeavour, and he was taking positions as we went down the coast, and he was also studying the landscape and comparing the land or what he saw with the descriptions that Cook had written in his own journal. And that actually fascinated me, the connection with the past. And so when I was writing my thesis, I thought, why don't I try and weave some pertinent comments from Cook? But as my thesis was about the Inner Hauraki Gulf, Cook really sailed past. And so apart from being on the east side of Waiheke and Pōnui, Pakatoa and so on, which he called the Western Isles, he didn't have that much to say. But a friend of mine, historian Paul Monin, said, you should be looking at Dumont d'Urville. Olive Wright wrote a translation of parts of his journal, and you'll find that of relevance, which I did. And that awakened my curiosity, and that's when my research, I guess, into this area began. I was trying to link it with natural history, and I was to discover that a lot of our native bird species in particular, but not just birds, fish, plants, were discovered for science. And I make that emphasis because Most of the time, these birds were long discovered by the indigenous people, the Maori people in this case. But our own natural history and our own natural science owes a lot to the French explorers.
Yeah, I did. I had noticed that use of the discovered for science and appreciated. You'll be glad to know that it didn't go unnoticed. You used it also in terms of land masses, such and such an area, an island was discovered for science rather than having been discovered since the navigators of the time, Polynesian navigators of the time, often did know. So yeah, one of the things that's most interesting about the book is this, which I feel we sort of have gotten away from in our modern times when people have become so specialized, is that dual role of these expeditions as exploration of landmass and as an attempt to gain more knowledge in the natural sphere. And it was a great age, wasn't it, the 18th century, for the categorization we had was coming head on the heels. You give an intro in the book of the Linnaeus and the categorization. What's it called? Categorization? When, you know, with the names of the species and the fact that there was no standard coded way to name these.
Oh, yes. The Linnaean naming system. Binomial system, yes.
Yeah. I was calling it categorization. I was probably thinking as a librarian. But the French contribution in particular, which is the subject of your book. And, oh, by the way, I heard that you also taught yourself French to be able to read the original documents that had not been translated.
Well, my teachers wouldn't say that, but I've studied French off and on, but I have to say it's enough to get me by translating documents on geography and biology, but I'm certainly no great French speaker, really. It's enough to get by the research institutes in Paris, but it is an interest, but I don't claim to be that great at it.
Well, I should have said, taught yourself to read French, perhaps, which is in this case.
It's quite
important.
Easy to read for me.
Yeah. The French contribution, which you look at in this book, so which you also point out, is an untold story in many ways, underestimated, underrecognized, included such things as solving the mysteries of the lost Solomon Islands and, of course, the great southern continent closer to home. And the timeline of the book runs from the discovery of Tahiti, of the Cook's Transit of Venus expedition, right up to post-Napoleonic times. I was very touched. I don't know why it was particularly touching to me, that scene where D'Urville is taking the last Bourbon king of France to exile, sort of a closing of a whole time period, and a little bit outside the timeline of the book, in 1830, it's in one of the epilogues. But what I appreciate, being a very person about this book, is that to allow us to grasp these stories, what you've done is follow the key characters. So you're illuminating their personalities and you're illuminating their journeys. This is so, as you mentioned, Surville, Marion Dufresne, Dumont d'Urville, La Perouse, who, interestingly, I saw Bonaparte had applied, Napoleon had applied to join one of his expeditions, and Dr. Lassant. And I want to pay a compliment to your book in saying that when I began reading it, I was thinking, I'll never learn to tell these people apart. But I did. When I got to the end of the book, they were all very clear in my mind. So what I wanted to ask to start off was, I remember when I first read Simon Schama's book about the French Revolution, and he made the point of saying that when he had been educated as a historian, it was taught that only populaces, only populations changed history or affected history and not individuals, but that he, in his book about the revolution, he was claiming exactly the opposite, that an individual could have a decisive effect on where history was going, course of history. And I'm not saying that exploration would not have marched on without these particular grand men that you have describing in this book. But do you agree? Do you think that they, in their enthusiasm and their talents as navigators and their vision and zeal, they actually did affect the course of this age of exploration?
Undoubtedly. And they were all exceptional people. It's true that history is made by people, not just blind evolutionary or economic forces. There's an interesting dialectic between the two. People make history, but they cut their cloth from the material that is available. But they were certainly larger-than-life people, and it's not just the French. You've got people like Cook and Joseph Banks, who were also larger-than-life personalities, and that seems to be something about the 18th century and the time and the opportunity when suddenly the whole world opened up for the human race, and everyone, rightly or wrongly or happily or unhappily, came to meet each other.
Yeah, I did notice that the people re-encountering each other on various ships and various crews, and you follow them through, especially in the epilogues where perhaps that particular expedition has ended, sometimes tragically, and yet the people go off and then they're on another ship where they are with another captain who had been previously involved in the story. And the other thing that really reminds me of is this note that I'd made about Marion Dufresne, who, when you were saying about the opportunities, and I was actually going to ask you about this, about people being almost thrust into these opportunities. So you described just in that first opening part about Marion Dufresne, sailor as his course of occupations, sailor, privateer, captain in the French East India Company, not drug pusher though, naval commander, colonial official, and South Sea explorer. It's kind of hard to think of someone that in modern times, you know, they become a NASA astronaut, that's what they are for the rest of their life.
Very much so. I guess it's the equivalent to space exploration. And actually, not only were these Europeans, the French and the English in particular at that time, they weren't the only ones, of course. Not only were they exploring the South Seas, the Pacific, they were also starting to explore the solar system. The transit of Venus was critical in determining the astronomical unit so that they could measure the distance from the Earth to the Sun and therefore the size of the solar system. So it wasn't just about Earth. They were exploring the universe in their limited technological way.
Yeah, and you do say, and you were saying, not just the French, but the English. And before that, in the book, you do point out the Spanish and the Portuguese had sort of been the kings of the exploratory endeavors, and then the French and the English came up behind them. Is that right?
Yes, they were the emerging, they were the great powers of the time, whereas the Spanish and the Portuguese, who began world exploration, were on the decline. And then the English and the French, who had been at loggerheads for centuries, really, over dynastic quarrels, they partially owned each other from time to time, took over. And it was their rivalry, geopolitical rivalry, which in many ways sparked the age of exploration, and indeed even the Enlightenment, though I wouldn't like to take a reductionist approach to the Enlightenment, but it was certainly tied up with global politics and economics.
Well, certainly nothing like a little bit of good competition to get ambitious people working even harder to achieve their goals. But that is interesting that you say about the philosophical also arguments of the time, because Rousseau and his idea of the noble savage, of course, comes the Enlightenment, the ideals of the Enlightenment come into these stories a lot. Do you have a personal favorite among these great men that you've told the story of in this book?
That's a really good question. I haven't really thought about it, but one has to admire Bougainville. He's such a romantic figure and a man of his time, an intellectual, a mathematician, a soldier, a sailor, a scientist. So he's an exceptional character. But the other one, I guess you could term a favourite, would be René Prémé-Vialesson, who features at the end of the book, and who was a biologist extraordinaire, a brilliant all-rounder, and a wonderful writer. And unfortunately, none of his work, or hardly anything of his work, has been translated into English. And yet he's so interesting, even gossipy. But his volumes, two volumes on the popular book he wrote about his voyage on La Coquille from 1822 to 1825 should be translated into English if we English speakers are to have a better idea of the exploration and the history of the Pacific. In particular, I'm thinking of the time Lesson and under Captain Duperrey with his colleague Dumont d'Urville spent in Tahiti and Bora Bora, and that's all very, very interesting stuff. And of course, their experience in the Bay of Islands. Though, to be fair, some of those journal extracts have been translated, and I'm thinking of the work in particular of Isabel Olivier, who was commissioned by Dame Anne Salmon to translate journals which related to the French visits to New Zealand.
Well, at least the journals survive, because I remember there's one part in the book, and I'm trying to remember, I don't want to get this wrong, is it Surville that the journals disappear twice, I believe, that you mentioned journals disappearing after the death of a controversial commander who had had experiences that perhaps were not, that his subordinates were not anxious to be opened up to public scrutiny.
Yes, Jean de Surville was a great sailor, a great commander, a meritorious explorer, and I would guess an exceptional man. But the truth is revealed that his mission to the Pacific was really criminal in some respects, in that they had a cargo of luxury goods on board, which was, despite cover stories, was really bound for trade with the Spanish American colonies, which was absolutely forbidden. An English captain had his ear cut off for trying to breach the trade embargo that Spain had over its American colonies. And so when he tragically drowned after arriving off Peru, and then a few days later when they got to the port of Callao, his successors, his officers on the ship Jean-Baptiste, they discovered that there was a scheme, an unlawful scheme to do this trading, and so they hastily tore up the documents. Otherwise, they were actually impounded for 3 years in Peru. But had the Spaniards discovered the criminal intent of the captain and his syndicate backers, then there would have been even much more grief. So that was a case of documents being ripped up. Marion Dufresne's journal completely disappeared.
Oh, that's why, yeah, I remembered. I was going, which were the two, was it? So both of them.
Yeah, so at least Surville's journal was kept up until he drowned, but the incriminating documents about the ambition to trade in Acapulco for Spanish silver and then double back to Japan or China, pick up another cargo, and then return to base in India, an extremely wealthy enterprise if he'd got away with it, but tragically he drowned. But in terms of Marion Dufresne, that is also problematic. His journal just simply disappeared, and I think that's a terrible loss for our understanding of New Zealand's history, because we would have learned facts or ideas of what was going on there that we can never really know. But the French weren't the only ones. When Captain Cook was killed, the last 3 weeks of his journal disappeared. And one suspects there were comments by the commanders on their subordinates that didn't reflect well. And quite often, for instance, in Cook's case, he would make an angry comment and then he would cross it out later. Anyway, yeah, that seems to be... I guess that wouldn't have been the only example of the captain's papers being disappeared by successors.
Mm. Nor perhaps the only example of a conspiracy, a hidden conspiracy to be turning something into a money-making activity. It's common in our time as well. Speaking of, you know, what you were able to piece together from all the various sources, and of course in every ship there was not only the captain that kept a diary or a log, but I was very impressed with the even-handedness with which you discussed the sort of double-sided... What is it? Do we say double-edged sword, a double-sided coin of this? On the one hand, these Enlightenment ideals for which many of these explorers were attempting, perhaps all of them, to see other cultures as a different culture and not simply as primitive people to be possessed or, you know, turned into. None of them actually came to New Zealand with the idea of taking slaves. But also a real appreciation, there's a part where you quote Marion Dufresne about saying to his officers who are angry because objects have disappeared after a visit from the Zealanders, as they called the Maori at the time. And he says that they have a different conception, that things are not thine or mine, but that they belong to everyone, and so therefore they shouldn't be judged by Western ideas of theft. And in the same thing, in Serville, you comment a lot on his kindness and his appreciation as individuals and as people of the Zealanders that he met and interacted with. And yet then at the same time, we see when you said recently, just before this, when you said cut from the cloth of their times, we see them switching into a kind of domineering, punitive way of acting when they're crossed or when things do not go the way they expected them to go, which would be quite beyond what we would be thinking of as normal reactions. And there's a part where you quote in the book about that this is the product of their time. So this, you quote Milligan as saying... Serville's personal code and the code of the service he belongs to will not sanction even such pseudo-benevolent kidnappings without the coincidence of a third essential. To kill men, to lead them away captive, to destroy their homes, and to exact compensation, all this was normal in 1769. So was that, did you make a conscious effort to weigh these various factors, or was that...
Yes, it's complicated, and it's easy to be judgmental and jump to conclusions. That was R.D. Milligan, whom I thought weighed up the situation brilliantly, but he did say it was common in those times, and it's common today, and I think he wrote that in 1958.
Yes, he does. So yeah, he does go on to say that. Yeah.
We're not that much different, really, to the people of those times. When you look around the world, when you see what's happened, somebody walks into a consulate in Istanbul and doesn't come out. These things still happen. But to be... So I've tried to call it as it was, as to the best of my ability. And I have to be fair to Serville. There was no violence at all in terms of bloodshed during his visit. That's credit to him, but he did kidnap Ranginui, and so he'll always be remembered for that, and probably more than anything else. But you have to compare it to Cook's visit, who was on the coast at the same time, and on the first day there was a lot of bloodshed. Now, you could say that de Surville was more diplomatic and more sensitive than Cook, but I suspect that part of the reason why things were so violent when Cook first arrived is that the people who met him, who encountered these strange beings, had no idea whatsoever who or what they were. And these people had landed. Whereas in the case, and so they attacked, and the British in this case responded with violence, in other words, with shootings. In the case of Serville and Saint Jean Baptiste, they Maori first encountered them on board the ship, and so that was the first encounter. So it was on, if you like, even though it was off Doubtless Bay, it was on, well, not neutral territory, on, but not on home whenua, if you like, and therefore they were able to, the local people were able to come to terms gradually with these very strange beings, rather than them suddenly popping up amidst them, as it happened in Poverty Bay. That's my theory, anyway.
Go ahead.
And also, of course, on the other hand, news of these supernatural weapons, muskets, the Maori called pū, had circulated very rapidly around the Upper North Island, and so they were, these visitors were treated with caution because of that as well. So that is why, apart from de Surville's need to be as diplomatic as possible, that is why the Jean-Baptiste visit was way less violent than the Endeavour visit. So it's not a sort of black or white, good or bad. It's a combination, if you like, of circumstances.
And I think that's well pointed out in other of the stories, which we don't have time, unfortunately, to go into all of them now. But with there's so many just very slight changes, such as we're going to stay a little bit longer because we need a mast, and how is that going to affect our relationship with people who've brought us in and made us welcome as guests, but now people are getting nervous about are we actually going to be claiming this territory, which is a different thing, and that's really well followed and discussed in the book. But as I say, unfortunately, we can't, we just tell people to buy this. How many pages are we? 400 page plus book. And there are so many stories, but there's a little one that's a jewel that I love, the one of Louis Louise. Could you just really quickly, we've got a minute before ending, let's give a teaser.
Louise Victoire Girardin, I believe, was the first European woman to visit New Zealand to see Maori people, and her story is very interesting. She was actually smuggled aboard as a man, and not smuggled aboard by the common sailors, but by aristocratic naval officers who connived to break Navy regulations to get her aboard. And the reason they did so was out of pity, because Louise had come from Versailles, was a widow, had been made pregnant and then deserted by a faithless lover. And she ended up on the doorstep of the townhouse in Brest, Brittany, of Jean-Michel Kermadec's sister, with a letter from whom we can only speculate, but probably from the family of the faithless lover, who may have been closely related to the Kermadecs or to the royal family. However, they took pity on her and smuggled her aboard, and it took the commander, D'Entrecasteaux, Kermadec, and also another commander who had actually visited New Zealand, Du Klesmeur, to pull off this caper. And so she arrived, she came to New Zealand, but tragically, she died, sadly, in the Dutch East Indies of disease, which so many European sailors of that time succumbed to.
And that's told so beautifully in the book. I did want to put in a compliment for your great writing there. It's a good chance. So this is all the time we have today, so get out there and get the book to read the rest of the stories. And thank you so much, Mike, for coming in.
Thank you, Karen. It's a pleasure.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz, and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day, every day, every day.